This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, the Trump administration is considering closing the recently opened U.S. embassy in Havana. They say that Cubans deployed sonic weapons against Americans.
Is this a pretext for rolling back the progress that we've made in American-Cuban relations? Sandy Levinson has an opinion.
We speak with John Bellamy Foster about his new book, Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce.
Back in 1935, Bertolt Brecht, the German playwright, said, "How can anyone tell the truth about fascism unless he is willing to speak out against capitalism, which brings it forth?" And that's what John Bellamy Foster does. Listen in.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. The Trump administration is considering closing the recently reopened U.S. embassy in Havana after several unexplained incidents that allegedly hurt American diplomats in Cuba. Some lawmakers are calling for the ouster of all Cuban diplomats, in addition to the 15 they've already kicked out of the country, a move that would have significant diplomatic implications. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson made these suggestions recently. They were the strongest indication yet that the U.S. might mount a major diplomatic response, potentially jeopardizing the historic restart of relations between the Cuba and U.S. governments. The two reopened embassies in Washington and Havana in 2015, after roughly a half century of estrangement. Of the 21 medically confirmed U.S. victims, some have permanent hearing loss or concussions, while others suffered nausea, headaches, and ear ringing. Some are having problems with concentration or common word recall. Some of the victims felt vibrations or heard loud sounds mysteriously audible in only parts of rooms, leading investigators to consider the possibility of a sonic attack. Others heard nothing but later developed symptoms. The U.S. State Department has emphasized that the United States still does not know what has occurred. Cuba has denied any involvement and has said it wants to help the U.S. resolve the matter. Investigators have explored the possibility of an electromagnetic weapon or an advanced spying operation gone awry. The U.S. has not ruled out that a third country or even a rogue faction of Cuba's national security services may be involved. Joining us today is Sandy Levinson, president and executive director of the Center for Cuban Studies. She was one of the center's founders in 1972. In 1991, Levinson spearheaded a lawsuit against the U.S. Treasury Department, which resulted in legalizing the importation of original Cuban art. She currently directs works at the Cuban Art Space, which she founded in 1999, to properly house and archive the thousands of posters, photographs, and artworks that the center has collected over the past 42 years. Sandy, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Gracias.
Sandy, what did you think when you first read the story about alleged sonic attacks?
I thought it was a joke.
What did you think of the timing of this?
Well, you know, what was very strange was that there was such a long time between the time of the events, as the State Department referred to them, and the announcement. And so the whole process of announcing what had happened was very strange, because it happened at one point in time, and several months later, we started talking about it. So, you know, it all seemed a little odd, shall we say.
A little fishy.
Yes, a little fishy. I mean, you know, and of course, with the Trump administration, you can't really take seriously anything you hear the first time, especially if it comes out of the mouths of Trump spokespeople.
Right. Or his tweets.
Or his tweets.
Sandy, this last year, an estimated 500,000 Americans visited Cuba. This was obviously a huge boost to the Cuban economy Do you think that the steps the Trump administration has taken to roll back the beginnings of a normalization of relationships with Cuba was motivated by an effort to hurt the Cuban economy?
Well, I think without a doubt. I mean, after all, this has been our policy since the very beginning of the Cuban Revolution, to try in some way to kill the revolution, kill Fidel, do anything we could to roll back what was clearly seen as a process that had the possibility of changing not just Cuba, but much of Latin America. So I think that from the very beginning of the Trump administration, since, remember, we are seeing an administration whose only political program seems to be to roll back anything Obama did. And clearly, because of its supposed importance in the electoral process, Florida and the Florida right wing has been important in some way to Trump's thinking. So it's not surprising. I mean, I think that those of us who have worked with Cuba and tried to improve U.S.-Cuba relations for all of these years, we clearly expected something from the Trump administration that would attempt to roll back what Obama had done.
Sandy, to get back to your point that it seemed odd and Heidi said seemed fishy, exactly what are the allegations that Trump administration is leveling against Cuba with respect to the diplomats who claim to have been affected negatively health-wise?
Well, of course, I mean, we are accusing the Cuban government of doing something. And I think, you know, there was a very interesting article that appeared in the Guardian newspaper not long ago, in which it was suggested that mass psychogenic illness is the most likely cause. The only thing that makes any sense is a form of mass hysteria, that somebody suffered something once, told somebody else. Everybody got very nervous because they're working in a highly tense atmosphere at the U.S. Embassy in Cuba. And it's very interesting to me that that is not only a suggestion made by The Guardian or by The New York Times or by other analysts, but it's also something that those of us who have worked with Cuba for a long time have thought about. I mean, you know, we think of ourselves and we say, well, I mean, we wouldn't be affected by that. But we all know that sometimes it does. We know that we're in a room where if somebody starts coughing, we start coughing. We know if we're in a room where somebody yawns, we start yawning. If you scratch, Heidi, I'm going to start scratching and I'm going to feel itchy. And so in a way, it's not shocking that newspapers, magazines, journals, as important as The Guardian and The New York Times, who, when they say that mass psychogenic illness is probably the most likely cause, we can't just laugh it off.
Right. Sandy, let's talk about the role that Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida who represents the most right-wing interests in the Cuban community there, what role did he play in the beginning of reversal of relations between the two nations?
Well, of course, Rubio is a kind of interesting character because he's always tried to present himself as something he isn't. And I think that after the debacle of the election, with Trump referring to him as Little Marco, et cetera, he had to get his mojo back, shall we say. And I think that one way he saw this as a possibility was to take control of the Cuba issue. Marco Rubio does not have a long history of strong relationships, pro or con, one thing or another having to do with Cuba. He's only done what is necessary to be reelected and to be considered whatever he thinks he should be considered at the moment, right? And I think that he saw an opportunity. For one thing, as you probably know, Rubio has been against letting more Cubans into the country, right? And so he kind of fell into the right way to think with Trump about immigration because of his belief that Cubans now are only coming to the United States for the usual economic reasons that people come from other poor countries. And I think that, you know, it was an easy thing to do. I mean, it was clear from the beginning, I think, that Trump was not going to roll back the possibility of diplomatic relations. Cuba does not play an important enough role in national politics for Trump's popularity to be affected by his base one way or the other. It was a payoff to Marco Rubio, and Marco Rubio knew it was a payoff he could get, right? So that kind of TV moment when Trump stood in front of the most right-wing Cubans screaming for blood, it looked like, was a moment of popularity and success for Marco Rubio. But I don't think that any of it was terribly important to one or the other. I really don't. It was payback. It was an easy payback for Trump. Made him look good for 2 minutes on TV for his base and for the Cuban right-wing community there.
Sandy Levinson, you organize trips for the Center for Cuban Studies. I've been on several of them.
And misbehaved.
And the Obama administration made it easier for people to go to Cuba. Individuals could go. You didn't have to just go in a group. They reversed that. Since the Cubans were doing a little better economically because of the massive U.S. travel to Cuba, that looks like it's going to be ended. But I wanted to talk to you about the larger context of the American war against the Cuban economy, because there's been a blockade against Cuba now since the very early days of the Cuban Revolution. And the nature of the blockade, I think, is not really understood by the American people, how total and devastating it is. The question of the blockade, which is really, in my opinion, a war crime, is coming up before the United Nations. Last year, the United States abstained on the vote, and so did its ally Israel. And the vote against the blockade was 190-0. And that vote is coming up again. And I wanted to ask you about the impact of the rollback of Americans traveling to Cuba and the impact generally of the blockade.
Well, I think that's really important, Michael, to talk about this. Let me just mention first something about the travel in the context of the U.S. embargo against Cuba, which, as you know, the Cubans referred to as a blockade because it so effectively damages so much of the economy. The travel is really what the Trump administration is doing is really terrible, because it is not so much that executive orders have been put in place which make it impossible to travel to Cuba. It is that the U.S. government has issued travel warnings not to go to Cuba. It has told the American people that it is dangerous, dangerous to your health, dangerous to your safety to travel to Cuba. That is not true. And it is not true that people cannot travel to Cuba legally. The only part of the travel regulations that have been rolled back at this point are individuals who do not qualify in one of the 12 categories. Now, what are those 12 categories? What do they include? They include, for example, support for the Cuban people. I'll let you think about that without my commenting. Another one is bringing back informational materials. In other words, it's completely legal for you to travel to Cuba if the reason for your traveling is to bring back books, magazines, newspapers, music, artwork that will be distributed as widely as possible.
First Amendment materials.
Exactly, et cetera, et cetera. So most individuals would qualify. But what the Trump administration is trying to do is, by intimidation, not by law, but by intimidation, convince you, a U.S. citizen, that you cannot travel to Cuba, while what they're saying is you should not travel to Cuba. It's very important that we make that distinction, because there is no doubt that the cutback in travel will severely damage the Cuban economy, which is, of course, what the Trump administration wants. The Cuban economy cannot afford to be damaged in this way. You know, it's not only, you know, look, I can say as the director of the Center for Cuban Studies that making people think that they can only travel in groups is good for us because we organize groups and we want people to travel in our groups because we think that we have more access than people will as individuals and we do more interesting programs. But at a purely legal level, you can travel as individuals. And by the way, we can help you travel as individuals legally. So if you need help, come to us. But in the context of the blockade, travel plays such an important part because, as you'll remember, it wasn't until the mid-90s when Cuba was suffering terribly from the collapse of the Soviet Union and the communist bloc, but particularly the collapse of the Soviet Union, when Cuba was suffering so much economically that Fidel Castro announced something that he had always been opposed to, and that was the resumption of welcoming tourists to Cuba. He knew what tourists could do to Cuba. He knew that inviting tourists once again, especially from the United States, would set up first and second class citizens, those who worked with tourism and got hard currency and those who didn't work with tourism and had no access to those U.S. dollars. He didn't like it. He didn't want to do it. He knew it would create an unequal situation in a society that he was trying to build based on equality. But he did it because the Cuban economy had to survive. And it survived. And with Obama resuming relations, people, for the first time really since the embargo was put in place, for the first time, U.S. citizens felt comfortable traveling to Cuba alone. They felt safe. They felt that they would not be harmed in their own country. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful for the Cubans. Many of the Cubans who had been able legally to start their own little businesses had not been able to set up their own little businesses until we started traveling in such gigantic numbers. And suddenly people who had studied English, people who knew a lot about the United States, people who were available to help in small ways, people who could open their own little restaurants, people who could open their own little, you know, I can sew for you, I can babysit for you. These things seem very little in the context of a large economy. But when a whole economy is based on individuals trying to get enough food on the table every night, this was enormously important for Cuba. And psychologically, you know, talk about mass hysteria. I think we can also look at what happened in Cuba. I mean, in Cuba, it was catching. You know, as they say in Cuba, se pegue. You know, it was catching that people felt optimistic about the future for the first time in a long time.
Sandy, listening to you, we want to hear what is the response right now among Cubans? What do they think about all of this? From Trump to these allegations to the, you know, rolling back of positive developments?
Well, they're scared, you know, because they can see their livelihood going down the tube. You know, they've always had, because we're the only new factor. They've always had tourists from Mexico, from Canada, from Switzerland, from Italy, from France, from all over the world, Japan, you know, but they haven't had us. And we're the ones that in many ways are the closest to them. You know, we're the closest to them culturally, we're the closest to them geographically, and strange as it may sound, in many ways we're the closest to them politically, too, especially those who travel. You know, let's face it, it's still true that many of the people who travel from the United States consider themselves friends. There are people who like the idea of a single-payer healthcare system. They like the idea of free university. They like the idea of everybody being educated and housed with no rent, et cetera. So the people from the United States that the Cubans see are us. You know, they don't see the Trump supporters. So we're going to be missed. We are missed. Look, I have gone to Cuba 10 times in the past year. I have not led a group since May. And now it's October. That is unheard of for us, even with the difficult time in the summer.
That's a shame.
And it's because of this intimidation of the Trump administration. As I said, it's not because anything much has changed legally. It's, you know, and then we have the sonic events, you know. Now, yesterday, Andrea Mitchell from NBC had a very interesting interview with one of the leaders of the Ministry of the Interior, who said, this is a complete lie. We did not do anything. The Cuban government has not done this, and we don't know who did do it. And what's more, you have not allowed us to talk to any doctors in the United States who have treated these people. We invited the FBI to come down. They have not found anything. You have not let us investigate. You have not let us come into the embassy or into your people's homes to see what we can find. And your security people haven't found anything. And as you know, I mean, none of us has heard from any of the individuals who were affected, right?
Right.
We haven't. I mean, I haven't seen one interview with one person who has said, listen, I want to explain how terrible this was for me and what happened. I heard this high, whiny sound, and suddenly my hearing was affected. Or I've had a headache for 3 weeks and I can't get rid of it. I mean, we've had no personal testimony to convince us that this is a real thing. Now, I do not agree with many of my friends have said, I think it's just all made up. I don't think it's made up. I think something real happened. I think something, as I said, may very well be mass hysteria after the first couple, three cases. But I know that President Raul Castro was completely shocked when U.S. officials came to him with this story. Because one thing Cubans know is that there is a group of people who must be protected, and those people are diplomats in their country. They are their friends. They are their connection to the outside world. They depend on them economically, politically, and even culturally. So for Raul Castro to be truly shocked by this, I think we have to have put some faith in what the Cuban government has said. They have denied it so categorically. They have, in order to invite the FBI to come and do whatever they wanted in Cuba, you have to be pretty damn sure that they did not know what was going on.
Agree.
Sandy, let's put this in a broader context. When the United States agreed to recognize Cuba, and I was with you and Michael Ratner down in Washington, D.C., 2 years ago when that happened, our analysis was that the United States itself felt isolated, that initially America was successful in isolating the Cubans after the Cuban Revolution. With the exception of Mexico, all the countries in Latin America and Central America went along with the American isolation policy. And if they didn't, their governments were overthrown. But that all changed. And towards the end, it was the United States that was isolated. And that was the impetus behind reestablishing relations.
Yes.
But since then, several of the more progressive governments in South America have been changed. Argentina, Brazil is another. My question to you is it possible because the United States feel less isolated now with these right-wing governments in place that they can reverse their policy and try again to isolate Cuba?
You know, with the current State Department, I do not think that there has been any serious reflection. Now, if we were talking about an earlier administration, I would probably agree with you. But I don't think that the thinking of this administration has gone beyond, let's get Cuba. I don't know even if the new governments in Latin America would support our policy toward Cuba. I think they do not, because Cuba's importance in Latin America rests not just with its government, but with its people. And, you know, no one has stopped travel to Cuba. No one has stopped open relations with Cuba. We don't know what's going to happen because, of course, in the past, we've used threats and intimidation in regard to Latin American countries. You probably remember when Cuba was going to sell Cubana Airlines to the National Brazilian Airlines. It was going to be the first investment by a foreign country where Cuba was going to allow more than a 49% investment. They were going to allow 51% for Brazil. And the United States government made very clear that if Brazil went ahead with that sale, with that purchase of Cubana Airlines, Brazil could expect no further support from the U.S. government. So I think that all of these governments have always been well aware of what the U.S. can threaten and what it can do. But I don't really think that Tillerson and the there are no people in the State Department working on anything anymore.
Well, they've expelled 15 Cuban diplomats from the embassy, the Cuban embassy in D.C. Do you think
I mean, that's what I mean. I think they can only do take kind of gross steps. I don't think they're having any serious reflection on policy. And what's amazing is that Tillerson, both in public and in private, has said that that the State Department does not think the Cuban government is responsible for these so-called sonic events. On the other hand, in the same speech talking about why the diplomats were taken out of the U.S. embassy, he said, "We do hold the Cuban government responsible for preventing any further such sonic events." Well, how can a government be responsible for preventing something that no one knows how it started?
Yeah, exactly. Sandy, we've come to the end of our allotted time, but before we have to let you go, how can people learn more about the situation we've been discussing, and how can people learn more about the Center for Cuban Studies?
Well, first of all, come around. I mean, the center celebrated its 45th anniversary this year. We are in the process of moving our headquarters from Manhattan to Dumbo in Brooklyn at the first of the year. But the center has a remarkable collection of Cuban art, Cuban books, Cuban magazines, Cuban movies. We have a full program, and we do trips. And I cannot urge WBAI listeners strongly enough to try and travel to Cuba now, especially in the face of what the Trump administration is doing to intimidate you into not traveling. As I said, we're more than happy to help you travel individually, but especially we'd like you to travel in our groups.
Well, I have to say, Sandy, that the trip I went on, the art trip to Cuba with you, was
you mean
one of
the last one. It was not only one that you went on.
It was a great trip. Cuban art, Cuban architecture is just really outstanding. If people are able to do it one way or the other, they should get a hold of the Center for Cuban Studies and speak
look at
with
our
you
website. It's www.centerforcubanstudies.org. Tons of information.
Well, Sandy Levinson, thank you so much for being our guest on Law and Disorder, and good luck with the center and their move.
Thank you, Michael.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
great issues of our times are the return of fascism to the United States and Europe, climate change, and the stagnation of the world capitalist economy. These great issues are pressing and interconnected. We used to think that the experience of World War II guaranteed that no politician would ever advocate the ideas of fascism. But the election of Donald Trump a year ago has caused a serious reconsideration of fascism and its relationship to capitalism and to democracy. The neoliberals paved the way for Trump. Now he and the forces aligned with him have put our democratic institutions under attack in order to protect the rule of the wealthy. The attacks include the right to vote, labor unions, public education, an independent news media, independent public universities, the privatization of much of traditional governmental functions, and making it almost impossible to launch a new political party. The election of Trump is a political development that, for concrete sociological reasons, allows us to see it for what it is, as a type of neo-fascism. Only by identifying the phenomena correctly can we effectively fight it. Jack London wrote a century ago in his famous book, The Iron Heel, that, quote, "There is a shadow of something colossal and menacing that even now is beginning to fall across the land. Call it the shadow of an oligarchy, if you will. It is the nearest I dare approximate it. What its nature may be, I refuse to imagine. But what I want to say is this. You are in a perilous position." We speak today with John Bellamy Foster, the editor of the magazine Monthly Review, about his new book, Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce. Foster is a professor of sociology at the University of Oregon. He has written widely on political economy and has established a reputation as a major environmental sociologist.
John Bellamy Foster, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be here.
Donald Trump has brought together white supremacists, Christian fundamentalists, neo-fascists, and capitalist billionaires. You've subtitled your book, Tragedy and Farce. In this collection, can you tell us what do you mean by tragedy?
Well, the combination of white supremacists, Christian fundamentalists, neo-fascists, and capitalist billionaires is certainly a tragedy in the political sphere, but that's not what I meant by tragedy. What I meant was something more complex and fundamental, and that is the U.S. economy began slowing down its growth rate. What we call economic stagnation actually began in the mid-1970s. And has worsened up to today, particularly with the great financial crisis. And the response of the system was the generation of neoliberalism, which was a kind of austerity approach. And that has ultimately been unsuccessful, and the economy is stagnating even more. And what we're seeing is a hard turn to the right, a growth of neo-fascism, as a result of this larger structural crisis of the system. This is a tragedy because the society keeps on turning to the right, turning the screws on the population rather than addressing its fundamental problems.
From a broader sociological perspective, who brought Trump into the White House, and what is his social base?
Well, if you look just at the election, and you look at it from an economic standpoint, which is always useful, and from a class standpoint, you find that Trump won a plurality of votes in the 50,000 people with incomes of $50,000 to $200,000. Those are family incomes. The bottom 50% of the population cutoff is around $56,000. So you're basically, you know, what in economic terms, Trump support mainly came from the lower middle class, primarily, not from the extremely wealthy, and certainly not from the working class, although segments of the working class, particularly more privileged elements, voted for him. And his vote, of course, came predominantly from the white population, which, you know, the lower middle class is predominantly white, and it came from religious, the more religious parts of the population, and more rural parts of the population, and the less educated. So you get a pretty clear picture. One thing that I find significant is of those who said that they had lost income in the previous 4 years, who'd done financially worse in the 4 years previously under Obama, 77% of those voted for Trump. So there's a very strong economic aspect to all of this, a class aspect. And it isn't really the white working class, as is commonly said.
Making a parallel with fascism in Germany under Hitler, did Hitler enjoy the same kind of social base, lower middle class, that Trump gets here in the United States?
The base was very, very similar. The political base is very similar, and this was noted by Gallup shortly before the election. They based on their poll data, but Hitler's support came primarily from the lower middle class. It came from religious Protestants, not Catholics. It came from rural sectors. It came from those who wanted an expansion of the military. But it's very, very similar, particularly the lower middle class base. In U.S. politics, the politics has been geared, the Republican Party politics has essentially been defined by the capitalist class. It's basically the Republican politics, although they have appealed to people who are down at out and the bottom, and people who are who have racist and chauvinistic views. The politics has really been defined by the top and the leading economic interests. The Democrats have traditionally tried to create an alliance between the upper middle class and the working class, but the politics has been defined pretty much by the upper middle class. To have us have a political movement that's actually based on the lower middle class is historically understood as quite dangerous, because the lower middle class, especially in our period, they are suffering economically. They're downwardly mobile. They are often feel rage towards the working class, and particularly the lower elements of the working class that are always the racially oppressed. And they tend to ally themselves with the very top monopoly capital, the financial elite, financial capital, but they rage against aspects of the system. So they're a very dangerous and volatile political base for any political movements, the state, and this is where fascism, in its various forms, has traditionally come from.
John, the title of your book is Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce, and I wanted to ask you about the farcical aspects of his regime. I mean, after all, these people deny human-caused climate change.
Yeah, well, I think that there's so many farcical aspects that, with Trump's tweets that it's we could come up with a very long list. But I would put at the very top that the rejection of science, with respect to climate change. Actually, all aspects of science are being essentially denied. And this is something that I never really expected to see in the political system in the United States, but very systematic rejection of climate change for clearly economic reasons is a kind of a farce. It's basically putting your head in the sand, ostrich-like. We see all sorts of aspects of this. And I think, though, we should not emphasize the farcical aspects too much. And then it's easy to see some people say, well, Trump is a clown. But I think it's much more serious than that. The way I define him in the very beginning of my book, and the book isn't so much about him as it is about the political changes that are associated with him. The way I define him in the beginning of the book is he made a statement where he could stand in the middle of the street in Manhattan and shoot somebody. He said this in a half-jokingly way, and he wouldn't lose any votes. And what that is a statement that he can act with impunity without facing any consequences. To have that kind of a president in the White House is a very frightening thing.
John, can you talk a bit about his advisors, especially some of the members in his cabinet?
Well, of course, in my book, the advisor that I focused on the most was Steve Bannon, who's now gone, but still has a very, very interesting and important relation to the Trump administration. But, you know, right now his advisors consist of, there's John Kelly, who really represents the hard right. He's been coming out of the military, but very, very hard right positions. Stephen Miller, who is a key advisor, speechwriter for Trump, he's really a very important figure in this, and he comes from Breitbart, of course. And there's Jeff Sessions, represents a kind of combination of white supremacism, Christian fundamentalism, and neo-fascism in himself. The administration is dominated now by generals. A columnist recently called this a benign junta, but it's very worrisome. The U.S. government has traditionally been under civilian leadership, and it doesn't bode well in terms of our foreign wars. Jim Mattis, who's Secretary of Defense, his nickname is Mad Dog Mattis, and there's every reason for concern in terms of Trump's advisors. Although Bannon is out and is sort of playing a role, in a way, a very supportive role of in terms of a hard turn to the right outside the administration, we still have people who raise the question of neo-fascism within the administration, and of course Trump himself raises it constantly.
John, you write that fascism is one of the two major means of political management adopted by ruling classes in advanced capital states. Can you explain this, please?
Well, what we consider the traditional form of management of the state under capitalism has been what we call liberal democracy, what political theorists call the system of liberal democracy. Liberalism in its classical meaning is more like what we think of neoliberalism. Liberalism means sort of possessive individualism on the market, free market individualism, that sort of thing is traditionally, in the classical sense, liberalism was a market ideology, very much a close opposed to democracy, and which democracy was associated with the rule of the poor or the rule of the masses. But what evolved in the late 19th century and the 20th century was a system called liberal democracy, which was seen as kind of a centrist political system that kind of an amalgamation of liberal views in the market and democratic views and basically erected around the vote and so on. And this is, you know, this is a liberal democracy is usually controlled by the political elites traditionally, and it's a system that works very well with capitalism. But capitalism has been in a deepening crisis for some time. To understand how serious the problem is, that is. Larry Summers recently came out with a chart showing that the trends in the economic growth, and by 2012, according to current trends, the growth rate of the economy since the Great Financial Crisis or the Great Recession will have been lower in that 12 years than the 12 years following the stock market crash in 1929, stock market crash in 1929. So in other words, the economy will be more stagnant over a 12-year period than what it was following the onset of the Great Depression. And this is having huge effects, and it's created a crisis for the system. And it's now affecting the political state. So the response to the slowdown of the economy was neoliberalism, which is a form of austerity politics. There's more to it than that. But it was developed by the elites and is very tied to financialization strategies. But this began to fall apart, and the lower middle class especially was suffering. And so we have a kind of a revolt from the right and the growth of neo-fascism. It really means the breakdown of the liberal democratic state in its neoliberal vision. And whenever capitalism becomes unstable, when accumulation isn't working, when the state is not able to operate, and it hasn't been able to function very well in recent years, as everybody knows, then as the system goes into crisis, it tends to turn to the right as its solution. And that means breaking down a lot of the human rights that exist, political rights, and concentrating power in the system.
John Bellamy Foster, you've recently had published the book Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce, and I read the entire book in the last couple of days. I have to say this is a really fine contribution, and I would urge everybody to get Trump in the White House. Say that Trump has secured a beachhead in the White House, but there are still loose ends, you write, that need to be tied up. And from their point of view, what loose ends are we talking about? What do they need to do?
Well, you know, they came in like gangbusters. Remember, and Bannon was the brains behind it. I know Trump wouldn't like that, but they were talking in terms of the deconstruction of the administrative state. It was a period of what was called Gleichschaltung in Germany under the Nazis. It paralleled that. Basically, it's not the same. This is neo-fascism. It's not the fascism that existed in Germany, but it's part of the same genus. And the goal was to gain control by basically bringing into line the other components of the state, because the White House is only part of the state, in political theory terms. Trump had the Oval Office, but he didn't really control the Congress. Even with the Republicans dominant in Congress, most of the Republicans were products of the liberal democratic system. They weren't. They didn't have represent the same movement as Trump or the same ideology. But of course they had to. They went after the national security state and the media first. They also challenged the legal system, challenged judicial review, went after the education system. It was very, very systematic at first, and of course, changing the immigration laws. All of this is sort of racism, racial ideology was used to enlist support from Trump's base in these actions. But it was basically the attacks on the various sectors of the state. They went after the scientists and within the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of Energy and so on, went after any kind of climate science. It was very serious. And they failed in some respects in this strategy because they went after the national security state, and the national security state sort of fought back, or what that's sometimes called the deep state, the intelligence community, because Trump challenged some of the norms with respect to U.S. imperialism, U.S. military, U.S. wars, and geopolitics. And, of course, you know all about Russiagate and everything else. And the initial strategy wasn't entirely successful. And the influence of this this revolt has been confined largely to the White House. They haven't been able to extend it beyond the executive as much as they wanted to. Bannon eventually was out. The strategy now, of course, is to change the Congress itself. And so you have Bannon supporting Ray Moore in Alabama, who looks like he's going to be the next senator from Alabama, even though he says that homosexual conduct should be illegal and is really a fascist by anybody's definition. Bannon supported, Jeff Flake just said he's retiring in Arizona because he was going to lose in re-election. Bannon supporting Kelly Ward, who is another rabid anti-immigration build-the-wall neo-fascist. And so they're working on the strategy from that angle. They're trying to strengthen Trump's base within the whole political sphere. So these are the kinds of things that are happening at this point.
John, the New York Times had several stories last week on Flake and the speech that he gave on the floor of the Senate. And they talked about not just Flake criticizing what's going on, but McCain, ex-President Bush. Flake was quite alarmed by what's going on, and he said, "We have given in or given up on the core principles in favor of a more viscerally satisfied anger and resentment. To be clear, anger and resentment that people feel at the royal mess that we've created are justified, but anger and resentment are not a governing philosophy." And I think that Flake hit the nail on the head. Anger and resentment may not be a governing philosophy for him, but that's the governing philosophy of Trump and his people. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. Flake was a conservative, obviously, and right-wing in his own way. You can't call Flake a liberal, although Bannon might. But he represented the old core Republican Party that represented the economic elites, and that would appeal to the lower middle class, but really represented directly the interests of power. But the political movement associated with Trump, this neo-fascism, is rooted in the anger of the lower middle class, the white lower middle class, And Flake retired because he was going to he was clearly going to lose. He could not win an election in these circumstances. So he is making a statement, but it's in the context of what was for him very clearly a political defeat, going to be a political defeat. And I think we have to understand the power of this movement that's developing on the right. It's not something that you can address simply in moral terms, although that's an important factor. You actually have to understand this in class, economic terms, and in more sophisticated political terms than people are currently doing. It's often talked about as though this is an aberration, that this is just a bunch of racists, that Trump is sort of, it's an accident. None of this is very useful. What's useful is to understand just how powerful this political movement is on the right. They're calling it a national populist movement, or a nationalist populist movement in Breitbart. And this is very powerful, and it's a result of the economic stagnation in the United States, the effects on the lower middle class, its effect, the decline of U.S. hegemony in the world economy. All of these things are part and parcel of this. And people like Bannon actually have a very sophisticated analysis of this in economic and political terms.
What would an effective resistance movement against all of this look like?
Well, I think it has to be much more unified movement. It has to be some kind of vast popular alliance, but it has to be, there has to be a lot of extra electoral mobilization. I even like to think of it as following David Harvey as a co-revolutionary coalition, but the various movements that are so powerful, the movements in the United States the social movements, organized movements, that they have numbers, an activism that's greater than the right. People have to actually mobilize. They have to take strong stands and not simply protest, but doing things to block what is happening. I think the movement for the anti-imperialist movement is key. The movement for Black Lives Matter, the system change, not climate change movement, the women's movement, feminist movement. These movements, they have to come together in a radical coalition, and you can't really depend on the liberals. You can't depend on liberal elites. We're already kind of bending in relation to this growth of this right-wing force. What we have to do is create a radicalism that demands more equality for people, that demands the human rights, that insists on fundamental changes in our economy and our state.
The title of your book is Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce. Extremely good book. I urge everybody to get Trump in the White House. And Heidi and I thank you for being on the radio show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, every success, John. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.